This podcast is brought to you by Podcast Nation.
Welcome to the Mom Room Podcast. My name is Renee Rina, and I am definitely the mom friend you have always wanted. Yeah, okay. All right, so welcome to our first YouTube video podcast episode. This is also the first episode that I'm doing with someone in person. Every single co-hosted episode has been virtual for obvious reasons. But this episode is with my husband, and it's the urology episode. Initially, we were going to do one urology episode and talk about like baby and children or pediatric urology stuff and adult stuff. But when we were making the outline, we decided there was too many things to cover for each. So we're going to break it into two episodes. So this is the pediatric episode. I also just wanted to point out that I got my hair done yesterday. And so moving forward in the episodes, my hair will probably never look like this again. So enjoy it while you can. Beautiful. You guys know who my co-host is today. It is my husband. He is a urologist.
Not a neurologist.
A urologist. I call him a pee-pee doctor, even though he does other things as well, like kidneys and such. If you want to know details about how we met, like our marriage, things like that, listen to previous episodes, and I will link them in the episode notes for you guys, just if you're curious. We wanted to put in a little bit of a disclaimer before we get into this information. Obviously, this is like general medical information. It's not meant to be like specific advice for you or recommendations. And of course, we urge people to go see their own physician if you have any issues going on. That is our disclaimer. I will put a more clear one in the episode notes as well, just to be clear. So the first question that I have for you is, maybe some people are wondering what a urologist is. So what kinds of things do you treat?
Yeah. So, I think urology is one of those specialties where if you haven't seen a urologist, you probably don't know a lot about what we do or the kind of things that we treat. To be honest, when I was a medical student, I didn't even know what urology was until, about 6 months into med school, when a friend of mine decided that he was going to do an elective, and I was like, oh, maybe I'll try that as well. So we basically are surgeons. We operate on the urinary tract, and we also do a lot of male reproductive surgery and care. But there's a lot of, it's sort of a balance there. We treat a lot of things medically, but at the same time, the brunt of our practices are typically surgical. And it really depends on what you do. I mean, as a general urologist, I see roughly 50-50 men and women, maybe a little bit more men than women. But if you're a subspecialist, that could be skewed quite a bit. Generally, that's sort of the breakdown. We treat everything from kidney stones to bladder dysfunction, incontinence, and then also cancers of the urinary tract. So anywhere from kidney cancers, adrenal cancers, bladder, prostate, testicular cancers, penile cancers. It's a very broad, very broad specialty.
All right. So what are the most common issues that you would say you see in your practice? I'm going to say just from living with you that it's kidney stones. Am I right?
I see a lot of kidney stones. I treat a lot of kidney stones, but it really depends on where you work. I mean, certain areas, you're not going to get the same number of stones, but a lot of the referrals that I get are either for stones, people who have blood in their urine to any degree, incontinence issues, and cancers, for the most part. And when it comes to bladder issues, men and women with bladder problems, for assessment.
All right. So we're going to get into the good stuff. So a while ago, I had put out on my Instagram stories a question box for you guys to ask questions that you may have for my husband about urology, obviously. And so the biggest thing that people wanted to know about with regard to children was circumcision. So the first question I have for you is, and some people may not even know this, but it's something that's so common, but we may not know exactly what is happening when someone goes in for a circumcision. Like, what are they actually doing to the penis?
Yeah, so I mean, every man is born with a foreskin, so that's sort of a extension of the skin from the shaft of the penis that covers the glands or the head of the penis. And essentially what we're doing for a circumcision is just removing that portion of it. So if you think of it like a turtleneck, we're removing the turtleneck portion. Yeah, exactly. And there's different ways of doing it depending on when you're doing the circumcision, whether it's an infant or even adults sometimes need circumcisions. So it really depends. The method varies depending on what you're doing.
So what would the different methods be?
So, I mean, for kids, you're looking at basically either a free hand sort of scalpel technique, which is, you know, what we use for adults as well. But there are other sort of more device-oriented techniques for kids. There's a clamp method, and there's also something called a Plastibel, which are just different ways of removing the foreskin.
And is one more? I feel like most people would use the scalpel.
Honestly, for pediatrics, the majority of them are other techniques. So Plastibel or something called a Gomco clamp. That one is not used as much these days, but the freehand technique is not used as often for kids, at least in my experience.
Hmm. All right. And so is there any reason why someone would prefer one method over the other?
In terms of who's doing it or the...
Like if we were going to get our child circumcised, would you have a preference for one of those methods?
Well, it really depends on who's doing it and their comfort. Okay. I mean, as a urologist, I would probably do a scalpel technique because I'm just more comfortable with that. A lot of circumcisions for infants are done by family doctors, and some places gynecologists do them, mm-hmm. pediatricians, and they may not be as comfortable when it comes to, you know, actually using a scalpel and suture and that sort of thing.
Okay. So last night we knew we were going to be talking about circumcisions today. So we were kind of looking up the history of circumcision and why it is even a thing. I know there's a really good documentary on Netflix about circumcisions. We haven't watched it yet, but I've been meaning to watch it. Yeah. So what?
I watched part of it.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, well, he's seen part of it. But so what is the history? Why did people ever start doing circumcisions? I'm going to move this.
Well, I mean, I'm not really a surgical historian, but... I just in reading, I mean, there's numerous reasons that have been sort of, you know, postulated as to why people were doing it, whether that's for, you know, ease of cleaning, whether that was to, you know, have some control over sort of masturbation and that sort of thing. There's lots of different reasons. You know, obviously there are religious reasons for it. The vast majority of people who are Jewish or are Muslim are circumcised for religious reasons. And even in parts of the world, like even South Africa, certain groups there do it in the teens, like 13, 12, 13, as sort of like a rite of passage kind of thing.
So I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Okay. So the biggest question that people had, is there actually any medical benefit to circumcision? So yeah. I know physicians work from guidelines. So in Canada, we have like the Canadian Urology Association guidelines. And then in the States, because I know a lot of listeners are in the States as well. So they would have a different set of guidelines. But do they actually differ?
In terms of like the general consensus, at least in North America, mm. the there's a consensus that there's no real medical necessity for circumcision. I mean, there are certain reasons why you would want to circumcise your child, but typically that's not just a newborn, right? I mean, if you're circumcising for a medical reason, it's typically because something has come up and there's a necessity for it.
Okay.
But I mean, in kids who have, you know, potentially recurrent urinary tract infections in the first year of life, that can reduce the risk of urinary tract infection. There's also some evidence that's been out there in certain studies, mainly in Southern Africa, where there's high rates of HIV, HPV. There's some evidence to show that circumcision reduces the risk of contracting or even transmitting those viruses. So those are, you know, some of the reasons for it. In sort of like a, you know, why would I get my child circumcised right up from the get-go?
Okay, yeah. So I think a lot of people, the thought is that getting a circumcision or getting your child circumcised will reduce the incidence of them getting infections. And I'm assuming that would mean urinary tract infections, or are there other infections that can occur? Yeah. And does circumcision actually reduce the rate of infection?
So definitely can reduce the risk of urinary tract infections for kids. But I wouldn't look at it as something where I'm going to get it because my kid's going to get infections. There's no specific reason to undergo a surgical procedure just for prevention of that, because you don't really know what's going to happen, right? I mean, the biggest thing is trying to, you know, if your child does develop some infections in the first year of life, then maybe considering a circumcision in those situations would be a reasonable thing to do. But as a neonatal, so in the first, you know, first month of life, basically, should you get a circumcision for medical reasons? There's not really a lot of evidence to support that.
Okay. So that was kind of one of the questions, was what are some reasons that it should be done? So that you just kind of explained. So if there's recurring infections, that might be something that you want to look at. So are there any other pros to having it done?
From a prevention standpoint?
Or just in general?
I mean, I think from a medical standpoint, those would be the only real reasons.
Right.
I mean, certainly there are other reasons why we would need to do circumcision, where, you know, if like a child has developed a lot of scarring around at the tip of the foreskin, can't pee properly because of that, or is having issues with something called balanoplastitis or balanitis, where there's inflammation of the inner foreskin or the head of the penis at times. Those are reasons to consider a circumcision.
Those things are recurring. So we'll get into possible complications that can occur, and also I guess like cons. I guess that's kind of the same thing. So cons to having a circumcision. I'm sure you've seen in your practice complications arise, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay.
I mean, I wouldn't suggest that anyone think of circumcision as a, you know, minor procedure. It's not like getting your ears pierced. It is a surgical procedure. There can be complications that arise from that, whether it's bleeding, you know, infections from the surgery. You know, you can get issues where, you know, even part of the penis is amputated or cut off during a procedure. You can get necrosis of the penis in certain situations. You can also get adhesions that form when things are healing, which oftentimes need procedures in the future to deal with. The other thing is stenosis, or tightness of the end of the urethra. We call that meatal stenosis, which typically for kids who are uncircumcised, it's not an issue. But for kids who are circumcised, the end of the penis is kind of rubbing on the inside of the diaper all the time. Mm. And that causes a bit of inflammation, and that can cause the opening to kind of scar down and close up. And that can sometimes have implications when they're trying to pee. So those are, you know, all potential side effects or complications.
This episode is brought to you by Little Spoon. I'm just going to be honest here. As a busy parent, it's important to keep your life simple and convenient, especially at mealtimes. Nobody ever told me how stressful mealtimes can be. Little Spoon is one way to help you do just that. Little Spoon delivers fresh, healthy meals and snacks straight to your door that your kiddo will love at every eating stage they are in. Their goal is simple. It's to keep your kid healthy, but also to make it the easiest part of your day so that you can cut through all the drama of mealtime without compromise. Little Spoon's baby blends are fresh, organic baby food from single ingredients to multi-textured purees to take the stress out of starting solids. Their biteables are transition to table early finger food meals that are cut to size to promote easy self-feeding with healthy, balanced foods that are free of artificial junk. Little Spoon's plates are for toddlers and big kids. They taste amazing, and even the pickiest eaters will love them. Think hidden veggie mac and cheese, chicken nuggets, and adventurous eats like pot stickers, gnocchi, and more. Little Spoon also offers smoothies, lunchers, and snacks. Did I mention it gets delivered right to your door? It is so flexible, so easy, and everything stores right in the fridge and freezer. You can check out the menu and change up what you order every single time. The price is right, the quality is unmatched, your kids will love it. It's a huge win-win for your family. So simplify your kiddo's mealtime with 30% off your first order. Go to littlespoon.com/momroom and enter our code MOMROOM at checkout to get 30% off your first Little Spoon order. And it's time to give a shout out to Claritin for supporting this episode of The Mom Room and providing me with samples. Thank you, Claritin. Guys, I am starting to come to terms with the fact that I do suffer from allergies. I used to think, oh, I just have really bad sinuses. No, you have allergies. So let's talk a little bit about my symptoms. I wake up with not a stuffed nose, but like I have to blow my nose constantly. So it's like it's producing mucus and I have to keep blowing my nose. It's all itchy. The palate, like the roof of my mouth is itchy in the mornings and I'm trying to like scratch it with my tongue. It's really irritating. And the insides of my ears get itchy. It's one thing to have those symptoms when I'm just hanging out at home. But for example, yesterday I was at book club and my nose kept getting so tingly and itchy and I kept having to go to the bathroom to blow my nose. Luckily for those of us who live with the symptoms of allergies, we can live Claritin Clear with Claritin D. It's designed for serious allergy sufferers. Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose so you can breathe better. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sneezing, a runny nose, itchy and watery eyes, an itchy nose and throat, and sinus congestion and pressure with ease. So if you're ready to live life as if you don't have allergies, it's time to live Claritin Clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter or ask for Claritin D at your local pharmacy. You don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin Clear. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Okay. I have a quick question, and this is not on the outline, but I'm just curious, when people go in to have their, let's say, newborn baby or young, you know, month old, whatever, baby circumcised, yeah, are they told all these things that you just said?
I would hope so. Okay. I mean, you know, everyone has their own spiel when it comes to procedures like this or any procedure in general. You know, you want to highlight the most important or, you know, typical complications, you know, things like an injury to the penis or you know, severe things like that are very rare. But certainly it's something that I would talk to people about. That's the challenge, right? I mean, it's really asking the questions and making sure that you're comfortable with people's answers when you're going to, you know, consider something like that.
Yeah. And, but that's why I love that we're doing this podcast, because like our son is not circumcised, but I'm just thinking if I went into a doctor's office and they were like, oh, by the way, there's not really any like medical benefit to doing this while he's like a newborn, you know, like you were saying, maybe later on, if he gets recurring infections, you might want to think about it.
Yeah.
Yada, yada, yada. I can't imagine them being like, there's no medical benefit, but here's all the complications that could occur and things that could arise. And then being like, oh yeah, let's do it. So I think this is good information, because I'm just thinking maybe like, I'm just wondering if it's common for physicians to tell people all the potential complications.
Well, you should be. I mean, that's part of the whole informed consent procedure, right?
Yeah. But sometimes I find with informed consent, and for me, like, you go in, you're going to have something done, and it's like, you know, they just kind of like, it's just like, oh, here's what could occur, but it's not really, like, the way you just described it was more like, you know, I could understand how that would happen. Like, it would rub against the diaper, and then you're going to have this problem and this problem. But I feel like, for the most part, when people are told about potential complications, it's kind of like just glazed over. And people, like, on the other end are not
I think the issue is, you know, you don't want people to be worried about this, because obviously these complications and things are relatively rare. Like, they're not a high frequency event. But at the end of the day, if you have something happen and then you need more procedures down the road to fix it, then you're going to be upset that you weren't told about it.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. So you explained a little bit why someone would have to be circumcised later on. So, like, the recurring infections. But are there reasons why someone would have to be circumcised, like, really later on? You know, like a teenager or something? And so what would that be?
So, I mean, in general, at least in my practice, the main reason for it is if they start to have something called phimosis, or scarring and tightness at the end of the foreskin where they can't pull it back. They can't expose the head of the penis. Mm-hmm. Some people have, you know, partial exposure, but they can't get it all the way over the head of the penis. And, you know, you get issues with bleeding and tearing, you know, with erections, with intercourse. Those are all reasons to do it. Those are the typical indications as, you know, an adolescent in patients in their 20s and beyond.
Okay. Yeah. This is just a fun fact that I wanted to share that we found when we were Googling stuff last night. So 1/3 of the world's males are circumcised. So it's 1/3. So that's just a piece of information for you. So next up is, and there was a lot of this question as well. So how to properly clean a penis. And it sounds so ridiculous, but to be honest, I would not know. Like, I usually let him do that with Milo and, like, check everything and make sure everything's good. But, you know, if I was on my own, I would have the exact same question, because I didn't know myself. Like, are we supposed to pull the foreskin back to clean? Like, how often are you supposed to do it? Especially if they're uncircumcised. If you're talking to parents right now that have young kids, so go for it.
So I think the biggest thing I would tell parents who are concerned about this is not to force things back. Over time, as your little guy gets bigger, the penis grows, they get more erections, the foreskin is going to come back. You know, there's a small percentage of kids where it doesn't. And in those situations, you may have to consider getting a circumcision down the road if it's not pulling back and they're having difficulties with peeing and that sort of thing. But the biggest thing I would suggest is not forcing it back. You can pull it back a little bit, expose as much as you can. But anytime you're forcing and you feel like there's some resistance, then that's probably the time to stop and just clean it what you can, right? You may have some sort of smegma build up underneath the foreskin. That's sort of the white sort of dead skin cells that kind of build up underneath there. But again, that's normal. I wouldn't worry about that. I wouldn't, you know, obsess over that. And certainly the worst thing you can do is to pull it back forcefully and then you cause tearing. Because then when that happens, it can lead to bleeding, which is usually pretty minor, but it can lead to scarring. And when scarring happens, that causes things to be even worse. So it kind of creates this vicious cycle that you're constantly trying to pull it back and it's getting harder, but you're doing it more. And then that can sometimes lead to issues where you have to, you know, consider a treatment that's surgical.
Wow.
Yeah.
Which is like, It's crazy that we have babies. Nobody knows this information, by the way. So if you're listening to this and you're like, oh my God, like I feel the exact same way. Like nobody knows this and nobody is told this information, which drives me crazy. Like you have so many family doctor visits when you go with your newborn, you know, in that first week or whatever, for the first year of their life, you're constantly in and out. Nobody is like, how are you cleaning their penis? Because I know there's people out there.
That's probably not the first thing in their mind.
I know, but like that's important too. Because everybody, like that question came up so often. And I know one woman had messaged me saying that she was like, she found every time she was trying to pull the foreskin back or clean the penis, like her son seemed super uncomfortable. And so that's probably why she was probably like trying to force it back.
So you don't want to do that, right? I mean, obviously if you're going to do it, you should do it when they're in the tub because the skin's going to be more lubricated. You can pull it back a little bit, but obviously if there's any sign that they're uncomfortable, then that's obviously a time to stop.
Right. Okay.
But I wouldn't really obsess over getting underneath there or exposing the head of the penis. It'll happen in time. But like I said, the worst thing you can do is force it back, because that can often lead to more problems.
Okay. And so as kids get older, is it the same kind of thing? Like you're just teaching them to pull it back, to clean, like when they're in the shower, in the bathtub?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And also when they're peeing, you want to, you know, older kids who are potty trained, or maybe not when they're starting potty training, but obviously when they're comfortable with it, just getting them to sort of pull it back a little bit so that they're peeing directly into the toilet rather than peeing into the foreskin, because that can cause this sort of ballooning of the foreskin, and that kind of creates kind of a chemical irritation from the acidity of the urine inside the foreskin and on the head of the penis. And that can sometimes create pain, you know, swelling, discomfort. To be honest, I get a lot of referrals like that from the emergency department where, you know, the kid came in with a, you know, potential infection, but it was really just, you know, they were kind of peeing into the foreskin and irritating things. So just pulling back enough so that they pee directly in the toilet bowl would be a reasonable, you know, suggestion to do.
Okay. Next topic is UTIs in children and in babies. So we had a conversation last night about this as we were going through the outline, and something that I thought was important to share was the part about like under 1 year old and then over 1 year old. So can you explain that?
Yeah, so I wouldn't look at UTIs as being a common or normal thing for kids. Certainly, if your child is having UTIs, especially if they're having fevers with them, that's something that I think needs to be investigated by your family doctor, or you know, if there's an abnormality, then sending you to a urologist. You know, before 1 year of age, typically it's more boys than girls. And then there's sort of a catch-up after that, and then girls sort of take over. The main reason in kids, rather boys under the age of one, is because of the foreskin. So it has an impact on being able to empty the bladder properly, and sometimes that can create infections. But certainly after the age of one, it's more girls, for sure.
Okay. And what should people... Because... You know, the problem all the time is that babies and toddlers, like, they can't talk or explain what's going on. So what do people look for UTIs?
Well, I mean, obviously looking at the urine, like in the diaper, if there's any signs of blood or anything like that, that's a reason to look into things a bit more in terms of investigations. But the biggest thing, and you know, we experienced this with Milo when he was, I think, 9 months or 10 months old, you know, any sort of unexplained fever where they don't really have any other symptoms or not, there's no runny nose, there's no cough, there's, you know, they're just kind of lethargic and they have a fever, or irritable and they have a fever. Those are reasons to, you know, potentially get their urine checked to see if they have an infection. The biggest thing is, you know, a febrile infant. So a child under 1 year of age with a fever, that typically should be seen pretty urgently to rule out anything dangerous. I mean, not just UTIs, but other infections, right?
Okay. And so Is there any way to prevent them, or things that people can do specifically, whether it's like with little, like boys and girls, to prevent UTIs?
Yeah. I mean, the challenge with infants is that there's not much you can do, right? I mean, it's really just, you know, treating them as they come. But certainly if they do, for infants, if they do develop an infection, then getting a workup. So you want to make sure that there's nothing abnormal in terms of the anatomy, especially for kids who are under one, right? Ultrasounds, that sort of thing, making sure there's no structural abnormality. For older kids, and especially kids who are sort of eating solid foods, and so toddlers and above, you know, making sure that they're getting a lot of good fluid intake, water specifically, making sure that their urine is high volume and dilute, that can prevent urinary tract infections. The other thing is addressing any issues with constipation, because the, you know, constipation can certainly affect how well they're emptying their bladder. If they're not emptying efficiently, that can have an impact on sort of creating a stagnant pool of urine that can have predispose them rather to having infections.
Okay. And let's just get this out, because people ask this. What is the deal with cranberry juice and UTIs?
So there's a specific ingredient, or it's not specific ingredient, but specific molecule in the cranberry juice and the cranberry that can help prevent bacterial adhesion to the wall of the bladder. The name of it escapes me right now, but that's sort of where the idea behind cranberry juice comes in. The only problem with cranberry juice is that you can't drink enough cranberry juice necessarily to prevent all urinary tract infections or have a big impact on it. There are supplements out there which are sort of the specific ingredient that has been isolated that can give you more protection. But yeah, it's just prophylaxis. Like it's not necessarily going to completely stop your risk of infections, but it's just something to do to prevent it, right?
Gotcha. Okay. Next topic is bedwetting. So I, you know, before even becoming a mom, you always hear about kids having issues with wetting the bed. It's not something that we've, you know, dealt with yet, because Milo is still in diapers.
Yeah, we have.
Well.
He pees through his diaper.
Only if he pees through his diaper.
He used to do that consistently.
That is true.
Yeah.
Oh, God, I forgot. Yeah. But anyways, I mean when they're like potty trained.
Yeah.
So, okay, so bedwetting, how common is it? Like from what you know or what you see in your practice, like is it something that's common or is it not common?
Well, I think the prevalence is a challenging thing to determine, because they're not everyone seeks attention for it.
Right.
People just think, you know, kids are going to grow out of it. And typically that is what happens. You know, obviously there's a certain number of people who are concerned about it at various ages and seek attention for it. But to really, you know, give you a true number on the prevalence, it's a challenging thing to do.
Okay.
I don't think anyone can answer that.
So within your practice, do you see lots of bedwetting?
I honestly don't do a lot of that. Okay. The challenge with that is, you know, just the rationale behind, or the reasoning behind bedwetting. There's not a lot you can do from a specialist point of view to really address it.
Okay.
Right. But we do certainly do a lot of teaching for family doctors. Pediatricians get teaching in this in terms of how to address it for their patients. But it's really more of a supportive role. It's not much to do.
Okay.
This episode is brought to you by Magic Spoon. You guys know I have been very intentional with what we've been eating lately. I'm looking at protein, I'm looking at sugar content, and avoiding things like artificial ingredients or colorings. Milo used to always want pancakes or waffles in the mornings, and now he is getting into cereal, and I'm so excited because Magic Spoon is the perfect option. Their variety pack has 4 flavors: cocoa, fruity, frosted, and peanut butter. They have 0 grams of sugar,
13 to 14 grams of protein, and only 4 to 5 grams of carbs per serving. They're made with wholesome ingredients, no artificial flavors or dyes, and I'm just so happy that he's getting a good amount of protein before he goes off to school. And it's a great snack for me and my husband too, because 13 to 14 grams of protein in the cereal, now you add a high protein milk, you're set. That is such a high protein snack or meal. I should also mention that it is gluten-free, grain-free, and soy-free. So go to magicspoon.com/momroom to grab a variety pack and try it today. And be sure to use our promo code MOMROOM at checkout to save $5 off your order. And Magic Spoon is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. So try a delicious bowl of Magic Spoon cereal today at magicspoon.com/momroom and use the code MOMROOM to save $5. Thank you, Magic Spoon, for sponsoring this episode.
So can you talk a little bit about the... like when the bedwetting starts. So because there's a difference between like it's a continuation from potty training versus like it happened out of the blue.
So, I mean, the technical term for bedwetting is called nocturnal enuresis. And so there's two categories. So there's primary, where a child has not ever gotten any control. Or there's secondary, where they've had control usually for a period of months or years, and then it's come about again. The secondary issues are probably more concerning and more of a reason to seek further investigation to look for any sort of underlying causes than primary. Primary is common. I mean, there's a lot of variation as to when control happens.
And right? It's specifically control overnight, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
Because kids may have control throughout the day, but then overnight they all of a sudden don't have it.
I mean, there's... depending on who you talk to, everyone has their own theories as to why kids wet the bed. But generally, and I think it's more of a broadly accepted point of view, is that it's mainly an issue with nerve control. So the brain controlling the bladder reflex that really hasn't developed enough yet. And also hormonal control. So there's a hormone that your pituitary gland produces called ADH or antidiuretic hormone. And that there's a burst of that before, typically in the evening, and that prevents sort of excess urine production overnight. And if that sort of axis hasn't been evolved yet or developed enough, that can lead to kids producing urine overnight or excess urine overnight, and then not having the brain control over their reflexes to cause them to be able to hold it, right? So that's why they leak. I mean, there are other thoughts or theories out there as to impacts on constipation and that sort of thing, but generally those are the reasons.
Okay, so if parents are dealing with the secondary kind of bedwetting, then it's worthwhile to go and see your physician just to rule out other things that could be happening.
Exactly. So anytime a child has had any issues with, or has achieved continence, so overnight or during the day, and then for whatever reason they lose it after having that for a consistent period of time, that's definitely a reason to go get checked out. Okay. And by getting checked out, I don't mean looking for something dangerous, but looking for things that could be bringing it out. So constipation or other things like that. I mean, certainly there are significant issues which can present that way. Spinal cord abnormalities, brain abnormalities, but those are exceedingly rare. But it is something to make sure you get checked out if they've gained control, had it for a while, and then for some reason lost it.
Okay. And you had mentioned last night to me that there's a genetic component to bedwetting.
Yeah.
So it's something that can run in families.
Yeah. I mean, there's been no real gene isolated or specific sort of link, but certainly, kids of parents who had issues with bedwetting typically have issues as well. or just take longer to gain control, right?
And something that I think we would want people to know is that it is something that typically kids grow out of. Of course, our dogs. Like, of course. I let them stay up for this podcast.
Nothing.
Go in your house. Go in your house.
Go in your house, Muffin.
Okay, so can you just talk about that part? I'll put them away. About, like, that it typically goes away. And then potential causes of it. Like, go for that.
So, yeah. I mean, I think the biggest... This was an unplanned break here. The biggest thing to know is that over time, they're going to get control. And, you know, I wouldn't overemphasize, you know, accidents and things like that, which can make the problem even worse, right? You don't want to create a psychological component to it that's unnecessary when your child's not getting control overnight. The biggest thing to do in terms of management is one, containment. So things like pull-ups and that can be helpful. So at least, you know, they're containing the leakage. Other things you can do, they sell these bedwetting alarms. And I think there's a lot of different companies that make them. They kind of fit on the bed. And if there's any moisture that's detected, they sound an alarm and they wake the child up. And they can hopefully get to the toilet to finish emptying their bladder. But it's more of a retraining kind of issue.
And for me, I worry about kids struggling with bedwetting and then the parents almost like making it seem like it's their fault or, you know, like we don't, that it's not their fault. Like, as you explained, it could be something that is just not developed yet. So I think that's important to point out. Like, I can just see parents getting frustrated over something like that. So yeah.
I mean, you definitely don't want to make it a psychological component out of it because I'm sure they're already embarrassed.
So. Yeah, totally. So next thing you were going to talk about just a little bit was undescended testicles. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's another thing that we get referrals for a lot as urologists. Certainly as a general urologist, I don't get this as much, but pediatric urologists do. Undescended testicles basically are testicles that are not in the scrotum. They could be anywhere above the scrotum or even in the abdomen or absent. Usually this is something that is identified very early in life, usually on the newborn exam. That is one thing that they're definitely examining for, is to make sure that the testicles are in the scrotum or at least palpable. If they're not in the scrotum, but it's an uncommon thing. But certainly the if you don't see your son's testicles in the scrotum over, you know, a period of time, it's a reason to get checked out. The biggest thing that we're concerned about is bringing it back into the scrotum if it's present, or at least making sure it's there.
Didn't Bubbles have a...
Yeah.
Our dog, Bubbles, the white one, had an undescended testicle, just so you know. And so what did they do with it?
Well, you don't remember
Oh, yeah,
that?
He got...
When our dog got neutered, we took him for his first examination before getting neutered, and the vet was like, oh, I can only feel one testicle on one side. And then he was like, oh, we'll take out the one, but we got to make sure that the other one's not there. And just like for humans, the reason you want to make sure it's not there, or if it is there to remove it, is because you don't want this undescended testicle sitting where it is.
Okay.
The scrotum is the normal place for testicles. That's where the blood supply is the best. That's where the temperature is best for maturation. And if you don't have the testicle in the scrotum, that can lead to issues with hormone production, sperm production, and there's also a risk of testicular cancer in an undescended testicle. That's one of the most common sort of risk factors for testicular cancer. But for Bubbles, the vet wanted to do his neutering, but then he also wanted to do a laparoscopy, so put a little camera into his belly to be able to find his testicle. And so I remember examining him, and I felt it in his groin. I told the doctor, I'm like, it's in his groin. And he's like, oh, no, that's a lymph node. I'm like, I do this every day. Like, it's his testicle in his groin. So anyway, he got neutered. And before, luckily, I didn't have to, like, go in there and make sure he found it. Because he dissected on his groin and he found it. He's like, oh, you were right. I'm like, yeah, I was right.
So if you guys have pets at home or dogs that you're wondering where their testicles are, just DM me on Instagram. We'll get that sorted out for you. So, okay, last thing was torsion. So
the one thing we should talk about for undescended testicles is that, you know, you want to identify this early. So examination in the newborn period and every examination after that that you have with your primary care physician should be examining to make sure the testicles are both in the scrotum.
Can they come down and then go back up?
It's called retractile testicles. Oh. Yeah. So the spermatic cord, which has the blood vessels and the vas deferens, that sort of holds the testicle or brings the testicle down. But that has some muscles in it, so that can sort of bring the testicle up and down. So with temperature, with stimulation, that could all change the position. But as I said, the biggest or the most important thing is making sure that both testicles are in the scrotum for most of the time in their first couple of months of life. Typically in the first 6 months, that's when we're identifying undescended testicles. And there's sort of a prime time for surgical procedures to bring them back inside the scrotum. And that's usually from 6 to 18 months. And that's just to reduce the risk of testicular cancer and also to maintain hormone production and sperm production.
All right. Okay, last topic is torsion. So I hear about this a lot just because when he goes into the hospital, I always ask, like, you know.
It's not a common thing.
It's not common. No, but it scares me because I asked him what it meant and it just seems like scary. So what is that?
Yeah. So when you're looking at the testicular anatomy, as I said, the testicles sort of hang on a cord that's called the spermatic cord, and it's kind of like a soap on a rope. So if you have the soap down at the bottom, and then you have the rope here, but the rope has all the blood supply. So the artery, the vein that drains the testicle, and it's sitting in sort of this, in a bag, basically, inside the scrotum. And usually for younger kids, you know, typically the age group that's affected from, you know, young children into their late teens, that's the most common. But what can happen is because the testicle is not sort of fused inside the scrotum, it can sort of twist on itself. So it can twist and then cut off the blood supply. Usually we identify that on examination as a testicle that's sort of higher riding inside the scrotum. Usually it's significant, it's really painful to touch. And usually that pain is associated with nausea, vomiting. It's definitely one of the few, you know, urgent emergencies that we have in urology.
So if, let's say I had testicles, if I had a torsion happen, like, is it something where you're like, oh my God, like that just happened? Or is it something that can slowly happen and then all of a sudden you have pain?
It can slowly twist, and then as soon as there is an issue with blood supply, that's where you get pain. Okay. So anytime the blood supply is cut off, when blood supply is cut off, that causes some tissue damage, and that tissue damage causes inflammation, and the inflammation causes your pain.
Okay. Right? And if left untreated, you could end up losing the testicle.
Exactly. That's the biggest issue here is, you know, if you have a torsion and you don't fix it, that's called an orchiopexy, then with the blood supply cut off, it's just like any other organ. If you don't have blood supply, it's going to die.
Right.
Right. Usually, you know, when it dies, there's a small risk of infection because it's this dead tissue that's sitting there. But the biggest risk is that the testicle is just going to atrophy or shrink and then you only have one. Hmm. Right. So from a standpoint of maintaining function, maintaining, you know, hormone production, maintaining sperm production, you want to fix it as soon as possible. So usually the window from, you know, first onset of pain to, you know, the latest you want to get them to the OR is about 6 hours. But certainly that differs. I mean, you know, I'm pretty conservative. I would, you know, even if it's been 24 hours, I would still take someone to the OR to at least have a look at it.
Yeah.
And if it's dead, then you just take it out, right? But if it's viable, then you fix it and put it back in the scrotum, and you sort of tack it into the skin in the scrotum. And the important thing is also to do it on the other side too, because if it has happened to one, then, you know, there's a higher likelihood of the same thing potentially happening the other side.
Okay. And that's not, like, this is the pediatric episode, but that's not specific to kids. Like, that happens to adults as well.
It can.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more common in children.
Oh, okay.
You know, up to, like, you know, late teens. Oh. That's the most common age group. But, I mean, I've seen a six-year-old with torsion.
Okay.
So it's, and I've seen a newborn with torsion. So it's, you know, it's not, it can happen at any age, just very much more common.
Okay. Yeah. And so typically I ask guests to share resources for parents. And so the resource that you had mentioned was the Canadian Urology Association and their guidelines. So they are fairly research-based and, like, scientific, very dry, but it's such good information. So I will put the link in the episode notes. And is there anything else that you would say, like, for resources that we could put in?
So there's also the American Urology Association. Okay. The Canadian Pediatric Association has some sort of cross guidelines.
Okay.
But I mean, just, you know, seeking attention from your family doctor.
I mean, if you have specific questions, issues,
You know, don't be afraid to ask them. At the worst, they're going to refer you to someone.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're more than happy to see you.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thanks.
Thanks, babe.
Darling. This was our first YouTube video. All right. Thank you guys so much for listening. And we both hope that your children sleep tonight.
And don't pee the bed.
And then that they don't pee the bed.